White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another exciting episode of The International Jew. It is September 6th already, and we will be reading Chapter 9 tonight. We are Carolyn Yeager and Hattie Scott. Hi, Hattie.
Hello.
Okay, I think, as I've really been liking every chapter more and more, and I like this one a whole lot. The title of it sounds a little dry, but that's misleading because it's full of great stuff. The title is A Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism, but it really gets into some interesting things that I could learn more about. You know, I mean, it teaches me something because I am not that well read about Jewish history. I mean, I'm aware of all these words and so on, but I've never thought a whole lot about what they did. So, and I think that these writers that Henry Ford put in charge of this are, while they're being careful to lay all the proper foundations, they're going full speed ahead, and it shows in this chapter. Yeah, no comment?
Yes. I was thinking about how I'm going to read this thing.
Okay, well, you know, it's a long chapter. And so that's good, because I want to just tell
people... I meant
the
quote at the beginning.
Good. Yeah, but I know. You keep thinking about it and do something funny for us. But this is a long chapter. Not the longest, but one of the longest. And so, but the next one, chapter 10, is somewhat shorter. So we may not be able to finish this chapter. I don't want us to not be able to comment and just rush. So, but if we don't finish, we can finish up this chapter next week and probably conclude chapter 10 too. So let's get started. Go ahead.
I'm just going to do it normally, I think. We are a people, one people. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of a revolutionary party. When we rise, there rises also a terrible power of the purse.
Purse.
That's Theodor Herzl. A Jewish State, pages 5 and 23.
Well, that's that famous statement of his, and so true. So I don't think he says purse, though. But the rest of it sounded like it might be him giving a speech.
Okay, so it's chapter 9, The Historic Basis of Jewish Imperialism. A great unloosening of speech with reference to the Jewish question and the Jewish program for world power has occurred in this country since the beginning of this series of articles. It is now possible to pronounce the word Jew in a perfectly serious discussion, without timidity or without intimidation. Heretofore, that has been regarded as the special prerogative of the Jewish publicists themselves, and they have used the name exclusively in well-organized and favorable propaganda. They can.
Well, I'll just stick in here before we forget what he says here. I think it starts out great that they are claiming, after just a couple months, maybe 2 or 3 months of I don't know how often they put this out, but this is only chapter 9 as far as the book goes, publishing these writings. Yeah, they wrote them themselves. That's right. It has affected the public already, and there's a great unloosening of speech, and that people are now using the word Jew when in the past they did not. That's quite a claim they're making.
Yeah. Wow. And anybody can do that. I mean, well, in some context. I mean, if you pick like a limited context, like a university, and you keep putting out information, you know, like flyers stapled onto power poles or something, it will loosen people up a little bit.
That's right. That's why they're so against anything ever coming out, because they don't want that loosening.
Yeah.
So true. And there's some, that's just the first great lesson in this chapter. I think there's a bunch of them.
Okay. They can oust portions of Shakespeare from the public schools on the ground that the Jews are offended. They can demand the removal of one of Sargent's paintings from the Boston Library because it represents the synagogue in a decline.
Well, I was going to wait till the end of the paragraph, but maybe I'll just say this now because I want to add something more here. I'm very talkative about this tonight. When I first read that, I imagined that they had these Jews roaming around, all the cities and places looking for things that maybe were offensive to Jews that they could start a protest against. But it turns out that this was a well-known event that happened in 1919 about the removal of one of Sargent's paintings from the Boston Library. I looked it up, and I had not been familiar with it before. But let me find my, where's my, okay. John Singer Sargent was a very famous, great painter around that time. He was probably an American. He was a premier American painter at that time, and well-deserved. And he was painting a mural for the Boston Public Library called the Church. Something about religion. And he did two of these paintings, just as part of this whole huge effort that he had started like 20 years ago, and he was still working on it. And now he had just completed the church and the synagogue. And this painting titled The Synagogue, which I've used as a image on the program page for this program, inspired a debate about whether the artist had represented Judaism in a stereotypic or even an anti-Semitic manner, because he portrayed synagogue as a blind, ugly hag. Well, that's what it says in this one thing. It's not a very nice looking image person, and also looks very defeated, falling down and the crown coming off her head, and wrapped up in robes. And then he had portrayed, I didn't see any image, I didn't get to see the one for church, but they all say that it was a lovely and radiant young woman who represented church, whereas this old hag represented synagogue. And he failed to understand why this was a problem for the Jews. He really didn't get it, because he was thinking in terms of religious history and whatever. But it took him about 3 years before the Jews forced an apology from him, and he finally did give one. That, again, he was a huge person, as far as famous. And at first he just kind of dismissed them and looked down on their, all this hubbub and so on. But it said 3 years later, he finally wrote something and apologized and everything. So they always get it. They go after it. And of course, Boston, there's a lot of Jews in Boston. There still are, but it was all over the country. Jews from cities, every city in the country, were writing letters and calling and writing to their own papers and writing to the Boston Library, and just a big, big deal. And a little bit more on this. In the end, the paintings never were put up in the library. In fact, the whole thing was a kind of abandoned, the whole mural. And it wasn't until 2003 and 2004 that they displayed those paintings, which supposedly are on display now.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that's the power. 100 years ago, almost, that those Jews had then, they still have it. That's the tip of the same method that they use,
this censoring Shakespeare and from public schools and having paintings suppressed is what we call political correctness since the 1980s.
Yes, yeah, and they're going to, this International Jew goes into this more in later chapters in book 2, about how all these things they did in the United States, how they managed to, you know, take things from the schools and do all that. So it's really
political correctness comes from Jews. I know this firsthand. Those are I went to a college where the Jews would sit around talking about what was politically correct and what wasn't. You know, with approbation for political correctness. They agreed with it.
Yes, yeah.
They said that eating Ben and Jerry's ice cream was politically correct.
Oh, yeah, well, true. And all the liberals wanted to, we all had to eat Ben and Jerry. We all liked Ben and Jerry's when I was in school.
It was politically correct because they give a penny for peace.
Yeah, well, they didn't do that then, but somehow they were the in place.
Yeah. All right. But when anything emanates from the Gentile side, which indicates that the Gentile is also conscious of the Jew, then the charge of prejudice is instantly and strongly made. The effect of that in this country has been a ban on speech, which has had few parallels in our history. Recently at a banquet, a speaker used the term Jews in reference to the actions of a group of Jewish bankers. A Jewish guest leaped to his feet, demanding to know if the speaker considered it American to single out a race that way. The speaker replied, "I do, sir," and received the approval of the audience. In that particular part of the country, businessmen's tongues had been tied for years by the unwritten law that Jews must never be singled out as Jews.
That's another so good point. You know, and, you know, he used the word race here, this Jew.
Yeah.
This Jew that leapt to his feet. He says, is it American to single out a race that way? Sometimes they're a race, sometimes they're a religion. And, we know, would it be considered impolite to speak of Europeans or Arabs or Chinese or, you know, whatever kind of race name you want to come up with? No, they wouldn't jump up and complain. But this has been this is one of the main insights into the Jews that they don't want, that they talk about themselves all the time as Jews. Well, there's nothing they would rather talk about than what they do as Jews. But boy, let somebody else use that term.
Yeah.
And they
if you're non-Jew, you have to say Jewish.
Yes.
He's a nice Jewish person.
Yeah.
No one would have predicted a year ago that a newspaper like the Chicago Tribune could have convinced itself that it was good newspaper policy to print in the first column of its first page a copyrighted article on the Jewish program for world rule, printing the word Jew in large letters in its headline, and abstaining from editorial retouching of the word Jew in the body of the article. The usual plan is to do what an Eastern newspaper did when dealing with the same subject. Wherever the term international Jew occurred in the article which it printed, it was retouched to financiers. The Chicago
Tribune. I know a lot of people on radio networks that do that. I'm thinking about RBN, where was told that we don't use the word Jew here. We use like Mason or they gave me
Canaanites, Pharisees.
Right.
I remember Peter Schenck complaining about that. Actually, though, they talk about Jews more than they used to.
Yeah, well, everything's been opening up.
Yeah.
Well, I even played a part in that.
Savage, even, I heard him last night say, I think he said that Schumer, the Senator Schumer, is one of the worst Jews in the United States or something like that.
Yeah, well, he's a Jew, too, so he can
I know, I know. I know, but see, what he's doing, it's damage control. It's damage control. They know that attention has already been called to Jews. So the best they can make of the situation is to say, okay, there are bad Jews. You got us there. But there are good Jews, too. We good Jews will point out the bad Jews.
Yeah.
And, you know. That's what they're doing. That's what Michael Savage does. He does it pretty often, too. It's a regular thing with him.
Well, he has to be the bad boy. That's how he gets his audience.
It's kind of funny how some supposed right-wing media and even racialist media is more timid than Michael Savage. about talking about these things.
Right.
The Chicago Tribune, however, on Saturday, June 19th, 1920, printed in the first column of the first page a cable dispatch from John Clayton, its special correspondent, under the heading, "Trotsky leads Jew radicals to world rule. Bolshevism only a tool for his scheme." The first paragraph reads as follows. "For the past 2 years, Army intelligence officers, members of the various secret service organizations of the Entente, have been bringing in reports of a world revolutionary movement other than Bolshevism. At first, these reports confused the two, but latterly, the lines they have taken have begun to be more and more clear." As stated in, as previously stated in the Dearborn Independent, our own Secret Service is one of these, though there is reason to believe that because of the influence of Jews upon the government, these investigations were not pursued with the persistency that might otherwise have been given them. However, we know from Jewish sources, not to mention any other, that the Department of Justice of the United States was at one time interested enough to make inquiries.
Yeah, so here they're saying that that various Secret Service organizations of the Entente, which was the supposedly the Allied guys,
yeah,
our side,
First World War,
were checking in to Bolshevism and so on. Of course, that's very true. It was seen as a big threat by all of the so-called free world, but then they went ahead and allied with them in World War II. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, the Jews had taken over by then in the United States.
Yeah, and they hadn't yet, right? They were walking a fine line here, but we can see in retrospect from this, and this book shows it so well, how they managed to beat out, to win out time after time after time, and to what methods they used. And we need to be really familiar with their methods and understand them.
Mm-hmm. What the Tribune writer does in the above paragraph is to show that this interest has been sustained for 2 years by officials of the Entente, a fact which ought to be borne in mind by those who declare that the whole matter is of German instigation. And they were blaming the Germans entirely for Bolshevism. The emergence of the Jewish question into American thought was immediately met by the statement from Jewish sources that it was a German importation, and that the anti-Semitism which flowed over Germany and resulted in cleaning out the overwhelming Jewish revolutionary influences from the new German government was only a trick to throw the blame for the defeat of Germany on the Jews.
Yeah, get that.
Well, we talked before about the Independent Social Democratic Party. Wikipedia has an entry about the Independent Social Democratic Party, which was a breakoff group from the Social Democrats. And most of the major figures of that group that Wikipedia lists are Jews. These are the people that were agitating for an end to the war, which, and demoralizing Germany's war effort.
Right.
And some of them, like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, became communists, overtly communists.
And now the Jews are coming out, they were coming out and saying, oh, this is a trick. They're trying to throw the blame for the defeat of Germany on the Jews.
Well, it looks like there's some truth to it.
Yes.
American rabbis are even now unitedly preaching that history shows that every great war is followed by a new attack on the Jews.
I love that line. So the rabbis, they say, they're unitedly preaching now in America that history shows that every great war is followed by a new attack on the Jews. God, it's the Jews who caused the war and were responsible for all that, but now this is how they turn things around. They make it just the opposite of what it is, and that's part of their method.
Well, as we saw early in the International Jew, that the Jews in the First World War exploited the situation for personal gain.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about that, how they got into the war agencies
that's
and then
right.
used the
that's
connections
right.
that they developed to continue to profit after the war.
Yeah, they're war profiteers, but then they make themselves into victims of every single thing. And they're still convincing most people that they are victims. I mean, they still do that. No matter how much people know about Jewish finance, the Jews, the Jewish bankers and so on, how much people understand what Jews are doing, they still can't overcome, they still can't resist the idea that Jews are victims. And they have, for some reason, they need to be sympathized with. So this is one of their things. They really, I guess all the publicity they've done on that over these years, in the New York Times, in all the media about, terrible attacks on Jews and Jewish refugees here, there, and everywhere, and all this stuff they put in the media, makes a difference. It works. Unfortunately.
It is undoubtedly a fact that every war newly opens the people's eyes to the power which international Jewish financiers exert with reference to war. And it would seem that such a fact is worthy of a better explanation than that of prejudice. However, as the Tribune article shows, and as all the facts confirm, the interest is not confined to the German side. Indeed, it is not even strongest there. It is, quote, the various secret service organizations of the Entente, close quote, that have been most active in the matter. The second paragraph further distinguishes between Bolshevism and Jewish imperialism. Bolshevism aims for the overthrow of existing society and the establishment of an international brotherhood of men who work with their hands as rulers of the world. The second movement aims for the establishment of a new racial domination of the world. So far as the British, French, and our own department's inquiry have been able to trace, the moving spirits in the second scheme are Jewish radicals.
So this is from that Tribune article.
Yeah. Other statements in the article are, within the ranks of communism is a group of this party, but it does not stop there. To its leaders, communism is only an incident. This will recall the statement of Lord Eustace Percy, quoted last week from the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is anything but distasteful to him.
Yeah, we read that last week,
said Lord Percy. This is more
continues.
From
the... Yeah.
They are ready to use the Islamic revolt, hatred by the Central Empires for England, Japan's designs on India, and commercial rivalry between America and Japan. As any movement of world revolution must be, this is primarily anti-Anglo-Saxon. The organization of the world Jewish radical movement has been perfected in almost every land. The aims of the Jewish Radical Party have nothing of altruism behind them beyond liberation of their own race.
So true. Very good.
Advancement of their own race.
Advancement, yeah.
It will be conceded that those are rather startling statements. If they were found in a propagandist publication of no responsibility, the average reader might pass them by as preposterous. So little does the average reader know of the secret influences which shape his life and frame his problems. But appearing in a great newspaper, they must receive a different evaluation. Nor did the Tribune stop at the news article. On June 21st, 1920,
two days later.
Yeah, an editorial appeared entitled World Mischief. The editorial is evidently an effort to prevent possible misunderstanding of what the news article was driving at. The Jewish phase of the movement, he asserts, aims at a new racial domination of the world. The Tribune also says that while it is perhaps natural for the Jews of other countries to be engaged in this world mischief, the Jews of England and the United States are loyal nationalists and conservative upholders of the national traditions.
Well, that's good, isn't it? Oh, yeah. Oh, it's happening other places, but not here in the United States England. Well, our Jews are good Jews. And you notice, I noticed that they call them loyal nationalists. So nationalism was still respectable then. You know, you were supposed to be a nationalist at that time. But that quickly changed after World War II.
Yeah, it's good Jew, bad Jew again. It were well if this were true. Perhaps it is true of tens of... Perhaps it is true of tens of thousands of Jews as individuals. It certainly is not true of those internationalists who pull the strings of all the governments and who, during the last six tragic years, have been meddling with world affairs in a way which must soon be plainly told. The unfortunate circumstance is that all the American and English Jews must for a time feel a distress which no one desires them to feel, which everyone would do much to save them from, but which seems inevitable until the whole story is told and until the mass of the Jews themselves cut off from their name and support some who now receive their deepest homage.
Uh-huh. See, did they ever do that? No. We're still waiting for them to do that.
Yeah, I bet Michael Savage still talks to Congressman Schumer, too.
Yeah.
Or Senator, Congressman.
It's all an act, right?
Yeah.
Senator.
It is worth noting, it is worthwhile observing the contrasts and similarities between the Gentile and Jewish reaction to this alleged movement to establish Jewish imperialism over the world. Jewish publicists first deny it without qualification.
They're always using the word Gentile. That's one thing, you know, and that was common usage. But I don't like using the word Gentile for whites because they're really talking about white people and European people, but they make the distinction, you know, between the Jews and the Gentiles. Gentile is a Jewish word, and it makes it, you know, I don't know, it takes away from our own importance. It makes us kind of on an equal standing with them. And we're not on an equal standing with them, or we shouldn't be, because we have way more large population than they do. So, but anyway, and also Gentile means all non-Jewish people.
The problem with it is it defines all humanity in terms of its relationship to the Jews.
Well, yes, exactly.
It's Judeo-centric.
Yes, it is.
There's the Jews and there's everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't appreciate that.
No, I don't either. And plus here they're not really talking about everybody else. They're talking about, you know, Anglo-Saxons. But they use the word Gentile because they, again, you know, right already then they were taking on Jewish language, Jewish-inspired language.
Mm-hmm. It is worthwhile observing the contrasts and similarities between the Gentile and Jewish reaction to this alleged movement to establish a Jewish imperialism over the world. Jewish publicists first deny it without qualification. It is all false, all a lie, all hatched up by enemies of the Jews in order to stir up hatred and murder. As the evidence accumulates, the Jewish tone changes. Well, suppose it is true, the publicists say. Is it any wonder that the poor oppressed Jews, driven to madness through their sufferings, should dream dreams of overthrowing their enemies and placing themselves in the seat of authority? The Gentile mind, confronted with the statement, says, yes, but they are Russian Jews. Don't mind them. American Jews are all right. They would never be taken in by anything like that.
That's the same thing as they said above, pretty much, you know, that whatever it was that I don't remember.
Going a little deeper into the subject, the Gentile mind is forced to admit the existence of some kind of a subversive world movement, the power of which has shaken even this country, and that the moving spirits in it are revolutionary Jews. And then the tendency from that point forward is either to fall in with the theory that the movement is really Jewish in its origin, agitation, execution, and purpose, or to set up the theory that is a world movement, undoubtedly, but only incidentally Jewish. The end of both Jewish and Gentile reaction is an admission that something answering to the movement charged actually exists.
Yeah, the point they're trying to make is that through all this, no matter who's saying what, it is giving credence to the idea that there is a movement, and it's real, a Jewish movement, a Jewish world movement.
You get the, you mentioned RBN earlier, the you get in that Patriot, so-called Patriot media, which I used to listen to quite a bit in the 90s, you get all kinds of bizarre excuse-making for how it really isn't the Jews.
Yeah.
It's really still Freemasons. It's really the Illuminati. It's really Canaanites. It's really people that are not true Jews.
It's communitarians.
Oh, yeah. That's one, yeah. I remember there was this dentist named Dr. Len Horowitz that had some kind of AIDS conspiracy video that he was pushing.
Yeah, I read him on the internet.
He quoted from the New Testament something about how something about those who call themselves Jews but are not, or some garbage like that, you know. And to hear something like that from a Jew, you know, I mean, he's a Jew quoting the New Testament. Can he possibly be sincere?
Well, he's supposed to be some kind of a Christian. I don't know. He's a truth seeker. Yeah, I know. There's RBN, I listened to it. I was still listening to it. Well, I started listening to it later than you did. I was behind you. It was already in the 2000s, but 2004 or so probably when I first listened to it. But, you know, they've got every kind of fraud on there. They've had, you know, over the past. I know some of them that in the beginning I really liked and I listened. You know, I had it on during the day and I was taken all in. I even bought a few things. And now I know that these were just big fake liars, you know, on there. But, you know, it's a learning process.
Yeah. For example, the Christian Science Monitor, whose standard as a newspaper no one will question, has this to say in a lengthy editorial on the subject. In spite of this, it would be a tremendous mistake to conclude that the Jewish peril, given another name and atmosphere, does not exist. It might indeed be renamed out of one of the grandest books of the Old Testament, The Terror by Night. For it is, essentially, the psalmist's concept of the forces of mental evil at which, consciously or unconsciously, Professor Nealis is aiming. In other words, that a secret international political organization exists, working unremittingly by means of its Bureau of Psychology, though the world, which should be awake to it, is entirely asleep to it, is to the man who can read the signs of the times a thing unquestionable.
Now, this was in the Christian Science Monitor.
Yeah.
It was somebody who wrote an editorial. So it must have been kind of an anti-Jewish person that they allowed to write. But again, notice that it says Christian. You know, it is Christian Science, but, you know, it's a Christian paper that they were willing to question and to put credence in, you know, in Jewish conspiracy things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder what they really mean there, because there are a lot of this is my problem here. There Jews do a lot of stuff that's not publicized very much, but a lot of what they do is really not secret. You can find out things like, you know, the World Zionist Congress and when
that's
did they
right.
meet and what did they say. And you can find out that the Jews own mass media, and you can look at what they say. I mean, there's plenty of documentation like that already in the International Jew that we've seen.
Well, I see what you're getting at. And, you know, here they say, in other words, that a secret international political organization exists. And that's what the protocols supposedly show, that, you know, that they've got this secret plan that they're putting out. But as you say, as with most of this stuff, it's not really secret. I mean, they're not saying what it means. They're denying a lot, but you can still look at the facts. And here's where people, the facts are there, but people the people themselves will deny the facts if they're told, if, you know, to be politically correct, if it's not politically correct to do so. They'll just censor themselves that way. They'll put themselves into denial. And I think they talk about this a little bit here going on.
Yeah. I mean, as for the Bureau of Psychology of the conspiracy, we all have heard about the Frankfurt School.
Yeah. That's right.
The Monitor gives warning against prejudice and disregard of the laws of evidence, which is exceedingly timely and is indeed the desire of anyone who has ever undertaken to deal with this subject. But too often it is a disregard of facts and not of evidence that makes the difficulty.
Yeah, that's... oh, well.
It's a strange sentence. It is safe to say that most of the prejudice today is against the facts. Is against the facts. It has not been caused by them.
Is this there the Monitor, or is this these guys writing?
We're back to the main narrative here.
Yeah.
There are two preconceptions to be guarded against in making an approach to this question. One is that the Jewish imperialistic program, if such a thing exists, is of recent origin. Upon the mere mention...
Let me just emphasize to the, because I've got this all emphasized in my text here, but to the listeners, that these, they're saying there's two preconceptions to be guarded against.
Yeah.
And the first one is that that this imperialistic program is of recent origin, which means you should keep your mind open to that it's of, they're going to explain here, it's of ancient origin. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, they've gotten more power in... since the 19th century than they ever had before. That's one thing that Gottfried Feder points out, is that the extension of international law made possible international finance to exert power all over the place.
Well, who's the creator of international law? From what I was looking into a while back, it was the Jews. Jews are the experts on international law. They actually invented international law. Well, they're the internationalists, you know, as it was emphasized last week. They're the citizens of the world. They're the ones who love to be, you know, they're more familiar with world thinking than anything else, not nationalist thinking. And so, you know, they thought international law was very important. And so they're these great geniuses who developed it. And we're supposed to all be grateful to them. Ugh.
Keeps us from minding our own business too much.
Yeah.
Upon the mere mention of such a program, Gentiles are likely to think that it was formulated last week, or last year, or within recent time. That need not be the case at all, and in Jewish matters it is very likely not to be the case. It is very easy to see how, if the program were to be formulated today, it would be wholly different from the one which is to be considered. The kind of program that would be made today indeed exists too, but it is not to be compared in extent and profundity with that which has existed for a very long time. Perfect constitutions of invisible governments are not the creations of secret conventions. They are the accumulated thought and experience of centuries. Moreover, no matter how prone a modern generation may be to disregard such things, the mere fact that they may have existed as a secret racial ideal for centuries is a powerful argument for their respectable acceptance, if not active execution, by the generation that now is. There is no idea deeper in Judaism than that Jews constitute a chosen people, and that their future is to be more glorious than their past. A large part of the Christian world accepts that too. and it may well be true. But in a moral universe, it cannot come to pass by the methods which have been and are being used.
Well, I could say something there, but I'll let it go because I don't want to take up any more time.
But to mention the ancient lineage of the idea of the chosen people is merely to suggest that of all the programs that may have gathered round it to assist its full historical realization, it is not strange that there should be one very old one to which the wisest minds of Israel have contributed their best of mind and heart to ensure its success. That there is such a plan has been the belief of many deep delvers into hidden things of the world. That's kind of a funny expression, deep delvers into hidden things of the world. And that such a plan has at times had its dress rehearsals, so to speak, on a limited stage, as if in preparation for its grand finale on the universal stage. Is another belief held by men at whose knowledge it is impossible to cavil.
Yeah, so I had to look up cavil to make sure because I wanted to tell the listeners in case they didn't know what cavil means, but it's to find fault unnecessarily and to raise or to raise trivial objections. I mean, I knew it was something like that. So this is you can't really find any fault with what he's saying with that statement he's saying.
So then, it may be that we are dealing with something for which present-day Jews, even the more important internationalists, are not originally responsible. It may have come to them as part of their ancient Jewish inheritance. Certainly, if it were a mere modern thing, hastily conceived and thrown together after the modern fashion, it could be expected to disappear in the same era which saw it born. Mm-hmm. Another preconception to be guarded against is that every Jew one meets has secret knowledge of this program.
Okay, this is the second preconception that we shouldn't fall for. All right.
That is not the case. With the general idea of the ultimate triumph of Israel, every Jew who has retained contact with his people is familiar. But with the special plans which for centuries have existed in formulated form for the attainment of that triumph, the average Jew is no more familiar than anyone else. No more so than was the average German with the secret plans of the Pan-Germanic Party, whose ideas started and guided the recent war.
Well, that, you know, I said, what's that all about? Why would they even write that? Now, the Pan-Germanic Party was considered in Wikipedia as an extremist nationalist party. But to say that it's guided the recent war, I don't think that's true at all. Oh. We're talking about World War One. I mean, World War One wasn't guided or started by the Germans.
That's right.
So that's really weird. But it got in
there.
That's
some lingering war propaganda there.
Yeah, right. There you go.
The average Jew enters into the plans of the secret group just to this extent, except in specially selected cases. It is perfectly understood that the consummation of the Jewish triumph will not be distasteful to any Jew. And if the methods to be used toward the end are a bit violent, every Jew can be depended upon to see in that violence a very insufficient retribution visited upon the Gentile world for the sufferings which it has caused the sons of Judah throughout the centuries. That's typical war propaganda right there. What you do is you accuse people of whatever it is you want to do to them. You say, these people are genocidal maniacs, and then you go in and firebomb their cities or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. It's all, you know, the things that they say and that other kind of Jewish type people say is that it's just the opposite. They accuse you of what they're doing. They turn things around exactly opposite. It's amazing. And yet people And even I will, I'm so brilliant, but you know, sometimes it takes a while to catch on to that. You know, at first when you're attacked like that, you kind of react, you know, and you have to get your bearings, and hopefully you can come to your sense that you can come to the realization that these people are playing a game with you and you don't have to take them. So you need to see through what they're doing.
Still, with even these preconceptions guarded against, there is no escape from the conclusion that if such a program of Jewish world imperialism exists today, it must exist with the cognizance and active support of certain individuals, and that these groups of individuals must have somewhere an official head. This is perhaps the one point at which more investigators stop than at any other. The idea of a Jewish autocrat is too strange for the mind which has not been much in contact with the main question.
Yes, and if people aren't sure, an autocrat is a person with unlimited power or authority. Someone usually who's been given unlimited power or authority over a group.
Can do whatever he wants.
Right.
And yet there is no race which more instinctively supports autocracy than does the Jewish race. No race which more craves and respects position. It is their sense of the value of position which explains the main course their activities take. The Jew is primarily a moneymaker for the reason that up to this time, money is the only means he knows by which to gain position. The Jews who have gained position for any other reason are comparatively few. This is not a Gentile jibe. It is the position of a famous Anglo-Jewish physician, Dr. Barnard von Oven, who wrote, "All other means of distinction are denied him. He must rise by wealth or not at all. And if, as he well knows, to ensure wealth will be to ensure rank, respect, and attention in society, does the blame rest with him who endeavors to acquire wealth for the distinction which it will purchase, or with that society which so readily bows to the shrine of mammon?"
There's that word.
Yeah. The Jew is not averse to kings, only to the state of things which prevents a Jewish king. The future autocrat of the world is to be a Jewish king, sitting upon the throne of David, so ancient prophecies and the documents of the imperialistic program agree.
Well, I don't know who said this here, or what, if they're making a declarative statement, but that's a statement that I agree with. And I do think that's the intention and that's the belief of Jews, that this is the end that they have in mind.
A Jewish king of the world?
Yeah, on the throne of David, in their capital, Jerusalem, which they want to take over altogether.
Well, the craziest Jews might be thinking that way. I have a hard time believing that most of the people that are nominally Jews.
Well, no, they wouldn't. No, the average person doesn't think that, because that's too strange for them to think. But I think that is if you want to think in terms that they're suggesting here, that there is a world plan, a Jewish world plan from that goes back to ancient times, and is kind of, because it's so old, it keeps sway over the basic Jewish mind. It has respectability. It has lasting power. And that this is if there's a guiding force of Jewry, like the Sanhedrin that they're going to bring up, that is what they have in mind. And if there's any truth in the protocols, whether they're fake or not fake, that's what they have in mind too.
Well, it is certainly true that some of the Zionist Jews are raving mad.
Well, they are, and if there's going to be a king of the world, it might as well be them. And they love the idea referring to David and their old kings, and you know, they love all that stuff.
Oh yeah. There's an interesting insight into that in the Ultra Zionists, which is a documentary that Louis Theroux did for the BBC. He talks to this Jew whose last name is Luria. And the guy, his imagination is just a little crazy, and he seems to be able to rationalize almost anything.
Hmm. Well, that's true. That's what they are able to rationalize anything.
Is such a king in the world now? If not, the men who could choose a king are in the world. There has been no king of the Jews since before the Christian era, but until about the 11th century, there were princes of the exile, those who represented the headship of the Jews who were dispersed through the nations. They were and still are called exilarchs, or princes of the exile. They were attended by the wise men of Israel. They held court. They gave the law to their people. They lived abroad wherever their circumstances or convenience dictated, in Christian or Mohammedan countries. Whether the office was discontinued with the last publicly known exilarch, or merely disappeared from the surface of history, whether today it is entirely abandoned or exists in another form, are questions which must wait. That there are offices of world jurisdiction held by Jews is well known. That there are world organizations of Jews, organizations that is within the very strong solidarity of the Jewish nation itself, is well known. That there is world unity on certain Jewish activities, defensive and offensive, is well known. There is nothing in the condition or thought of the Jews which would render the existence today of an exilarch distasteful to them. Indeed, the thought would be very comfortable.
Exactly.
Except that there's no evidence for it. But
well, there used to be. What are you saying? They used to exist. Yeah. But you know, it's what existed then could still be in the minds of those who are kind of in leadership roles here.
Well, he's exaggerating the unity of the Jews there a little bit, I think. Didn't we read in an earlier chapter that the Zionist Jews were a minority of the Jews at that time?
Well, yeah, they were, but now pretty much all the Jews have accepted that. But but who was where is this, the world, that there is world unity on certain Jewish activities? That's what they say. They don't say, you know, all the Jews are all united on everything. They said on certain.
If they're all being governed by a Jewish autocrat.
Well, they're not. They're not at this point. But that could be part. That could be still the overall manner of thinking of those who are leading this from hidden places. Okay. Well, they're not probably so hidden, but
yeah, I prefer the sociobiological or evolutionary psychological explanation. The Jewish Encyclopedia remarks, curiously enough, the exilarchs are still mentioned in the Sabbath services of the Ashkenazim ritual. The Jews of the Sephardic ritual have not preserved this anachronism, nor was it retained in most of the Reform synagogues of the 19th century.
Okay.
Is there then a Jewish Sanhedrin, a governing or counseling body of Jews who take oversight of the affairs of their people throughout the world? See, this is completely redundant because he's already talked about all the Jewish organizations. He's already talked about the World Zionist organization and the congresses Herzl had.
Well, they want to explain to the readers about the Jewish Sanhedrin and what it was.
We'll have to go through this, but it just seems redundant to me. The Jewish Sanhedrin was a most interesting institution. Its origin and method of constitution are obscure. It consisted of 71 members with the president and performed the functions of a political senate. There is nothing to show whence the Sanhedrin derived its authority. It was not an elective body. It was not democratic. It was not representative. It was not responsible to the people. In these qualities, it was typically Jewish. The Sanhedrin was chosen by the prince or priest, not with the purpose of safeguarding the people's interest, but to assist the ruler in the work of administration. It was thus assembled by call, or it was self-perpetuating, calling its own members. The arrangement seems to have been that well-known device by which an aristocracy can maintain itself in power, whatever the political construction of the nation may be. The Jewish Encyclopedia says, "The Sanhedrin, which was entirely aristocratic in character, probably assumed its own authority, since it was composed of members of the most influential families of the nobility and priesthood. This body was flanked by a similar body which governed the religious interests of the nation, the members being drawn apparently from classes nearer the common people. The Sanhedrin exercised authority not only over the Jews of Palestine, but wherever they were scattered throughout the world. As a Senate exercising direct political authority, it ceased with the downfall of the Jewish state in the year 70. But there are indications of its continuance as an advisory body down to the 4th century. In 1806, in order to satisfy the mind of Napoleon upon some questions which had arisen concerning the Jews, an assembly of notables was called, whose membership consisted of prominent Jews of France. They, in turn, to bring the sanction of all Jewry to the answers which they should give Napoleon, convoked the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin assembled in Paris on February 9, 1807. It followed the prescribed ancient forms. It was comprised of Jews from all parts of Europe. It was assembled to put the whole authority of Jewry behind any compact the French Jews may have been able to make with Napoleon. In putting forth its decisions, the Sanhedrin of 1807 declared that it was in all respects like the ancient Sanhedrin, a legal assembly vested with power of passing ordinances in order to promote the welfare of Israel. The significance of these facts is this. Whatever the leaders of the Jews may do today in the way of maintaining the policy and constitution of Israel would not constitute a new departure. It would not signify a new attitude. It would not be evidence of a new plan.
You can do the next paragraph.
Yeah, except that something came up in front of my...
Oh.
It would be entirely natural, Jewish solidarity being what it is, that the Sanhedrin should still be continued. The ancient Sanhedrin appears to have had a group of 10 who were somewhat exalted in importance above the rest. It would be perfectly natural if the leaders of the Jews were today divided into committees by countries or by objects.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a few seconds. And then one more sentence I'll say. They are always being held year by year, world meetings of the principal Jews of all lands. And we've got not too much left to go, so we can easily take care of this next week, which we will finish this chapter and start with chapter 10 next week, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your great reading, Hadding. And this sets the tone for all the chapters to come for a while. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.